I'd invite your attention this evening. Now, you thought we'd go back, but we're not going back. We will go back, but not right this week. For a reason, I would like you to turn with me to the book of Isaiah this evening, please. Let's talk a little bit as we begin the background. There are some interesting comparisons, or if you will, relationship between Isaiah and Jeremiah. Now, first of all, interesting enough, as you and I look at this book, we talked about last week, the longest body of literature in the Bible is the book of Psalms. The second longest is the book of Jeremiah. And the third longest is Isaiah. Now, why that is very, very interesting because, well, let's go somewhere else and we'll come back to that. It is significant because there are passages in Isaiah that we know well. I've talked to you about, give me some passages that you know, just some things, passages that stand out to you. Of course, the one, probably the main one, is the one that was preached on just a few weeks ago, which is Isaiah what? 53. Certainly very, very, very well-known passage. Another one is certainly what? Which? 6? 40 would... What? 9? Okay. 40 this afternoon, all right? So we have Isaiah 40. Certainly chapter 6, saw the Lord high and lifted up. Chapter 7, chapter 9, possibly part of... even if you think of 7 and 9 and 11, you're only thinking of a few verses in there. We're not thinking about the whole chapter. Even for those who know the Bible well, most of Isaiah is very foreign. It is a pity. It's a pity that you have such a large body of literature corresponding, if you will. It is like the gospel account. It is the gospel of John, if you will, in the Old Testament in that context, right? Certainly presenting the person of Jesus Christ, the majesty of Christ, the ministry of Christ. So much of that, the character of Christ throughout this book, and yet so little known. I purposefully chose to do this section just as I did chapter 1 last time. I won't do chapter 1 this time, but basically actually chapters 1 to 5 purposefully because for this reason. There's so little preaching on the Old Testament these days. There is. And yet it is so relevant to our day, even without taking it out of its context, just leaving within its own individual context, so relevant to our time. Some of the most relevant passages in the Old Testament are, of course, the minor prophets in there. So many incredible statements, the minor prophets are crucial. But if you're taking a book that is so quoted so often, most quoted book in most of the, I would say most prophet books on prophecy, this is one of the most quoted books there is, aside from maybe the book of Revelation, but the Old Testament is the most quoted. If you look at the writers of the New Testament, certainly quoted an awful lot. Interesting because these two prophets, 65 years apart, one who ministered, this one ministered at least 35 years, Jeremiah a little longer possibly, because we don't know exactly when Isaiah started. We do know a call of Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 6, the year that King Uzziah died, but that doesn't tell us that Isaiah was doing nothing prior to that time. He may have been doing some ministry. But is it not significant that both of these men are impacted greatly by the death of a godly king? There is no doubt that when Uzziah died, of course, you remember the great Uzziah, a good king, and in many ways a godly king, but a king who, when God began to honor his godliness, then saw fit to walk into the temple to offer incense, and of course, rebuked in doing so, and God gave him leprosy the rest of his life, and his son reigned in his stead, as he was still alive, though during for over 50 years. His reign was long. Manasseh's reign was long. It's interesting, but Uzziah was around for a long time. And the nation began, in a sense, to somewhat decline during his time, but really after his time, rapid decline, as it did also with Josiah. And it is also fascinating. You can find kings like this that can bring a nation back from ungodliness, as Josiah did, as Uzziah did, and yet it is so easy to watch it then decline so rapidly when an ungodly king comes. I reflected as I was preparing for tonight on the fact that I think we need to realize how important godly leaders are. It doesn't, you know, people say that every church is only one man removed from either success or disaster. Now you say, why? Your church shouldn't be built around one person. Every time you have a church, though, you need a leader. You just flat out need to have a leader. And if the leader isn't godly, the church will not be godly. If a leader isn't godly in the nation won't be godly. And if somebody thinks it happens because of a corporate expression, all you have to do is read the book of Judges, and you know every time a godly leader rose, the nation rose to some kind of victory. But when the godly leader died, look what happens. For Gideon's time, for example, God raises up a man who has no great sense of pride whatsoever, and he will not continue with a family rulership, and yet in his death the nation again declines. Even his whole family comes, well, his one son then kills off the rest. So it just is a disastrous thing. And I remind all of us, especially those who will be involved in ministry, you must be a leader. You must be the leader. You must lead a church in the way of godliness. There is no way to ever, ever minimize the greatness of that. And you can't minimize that. I remind you again the statement that God, you must understand you're a leader of leaders, you're a leader among leaders, and you're a leader under leaders, but you are still a leader of leaders. And it will be framed by your leadership without a doubt. And so certainly in the death of Uzziah, a great time of disaster came for Israel, and so we find that. Now, what I want to do, though, is just looking at the background of this book. You know Isaiah's name is the Lord is salvation, and again, that in itself makes a statement about this book. Now why this book is interesting is because the very beginning of this book, in fact, the first few verses, indicate to us very, very clearly the nature of this book. In fact, he give us a setting for the whole book as a whole, and in fact, all of the books of prophecy. We have so much of this. So we start with this in just the very beginning. The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz. And this is not Amos. There's a great difference between Amoz and Amos. This is not he is not a prophet's son. Some have sought to think that he was related to a king, and it could be, but there is no proof of that either. That's speculation, but there's no proof of that. And it was the vision of Isaiah the son of Amoz concerning Judah and Jerusalem, which he saw during the reigns of, and here we have Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Isaiah killed, as we hear, in the reign of Manasseh. After the death of Hezekiah, Manasseh comes, and during his reign, Isaiah is killed. The Hebrews 11 passage sawn asunder, a reference to Isaiah, some think so, and possibly so, in the sense that that is an awesome death. Jeremiah, killed by the Jews down in Egypt. So the latter end of both of these men, martyrs for the cause of God, never, never declining in their ministry to be it. And interesting, the access that Isaiah has in the early years, to the presence of kings, and he did that. But anyhow, a godly man whose death was a very difficult death, and yet a death brought about by a very ungodly king. So he identifies himself during the reigns of these men, and his ministry took place during that time. Now, what I want you to look at, and the reason for looking at this passage today in chapters 1 to 5, is just for a while to look at the relevancy of Old Testament statements to our situation today or in any day for that matter. Now, it's interesting because as you come to this book, he introduces it with this statement. And I take you down to verse 4 because I would go verse, but there's a reason I want to do it this way. Because it talks about their turning from God, and he talks about this. And by the way, it is significant because so many of the themes of this whole book are tied up in chapter 1, which we're not going to cover in its entirety. We're only basically going to look at verses 1 through 18, and then it's some in references elsewhere. But even in this section, to find the words for sin. But notice the statements, the very beginning statement of verse 4, and I have it for you there. Hoi goi. Hote. You know, it's interesting because it's the hoi is to catch their attention. Goi, you know goyim, right? The people. And it is, but it's here, it is the people, if you will, the sinful nation, the people of sinfulness. It is interesting because he will then describe what they have done. And watch, if you will. People, and he describes, he says, people weighed down with iniquity, offspring of evildoers. The one generation after another continues to live in sin. And in the other side to this, sons who act corruptly. And so you look at this, so he defines this, but now he says, all right, this is what they have done. And notice the threefold statement in here in verse 4. First of all, the very first statement, he says, they have abandoned the Lord. Now, this is the initial statement of this. God, the one who has led them all of these years, they have abandoned him. He never abandoned them, but they abandoned him. What is interesting, and again, this is a sin in general, but more specifically, again, will have to do with the fact that their covenant relationship with him they have abandoned. But now, notice this next statement, and I don't know, somehow, we'll try to get significance. Look at this, they have despised the Holy One of Israel. Now, there, if you will go with me, you know the passage well. The sense of a holy God is certainly something that permeates this entire book. If you walk with me, if you will, to chapter 6, you'll notice with me there again this the call of Isaiah when he's called by God. And again, that statement that is made, the one angel calling to another, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. And when you look at this, you sense this, the holiness of God. And by the way, let me just comment here as you do this. But just as Paul's ministry, all of his ministry, was so defined by the Damascus Road experience, so Isaiah's entire ministry is so defined by his experience of chapter 6. You know, for example, when you look at Paul's statements with regard to that experience, three times the account is given in the book of Acts, three times alone that account, Paul giving the account in the book of Acts, because it had such a profound effect. And it wasn't only that. There are so many references that come through his life. And so the same thing with this statement when Isaiah is here at this point, and he is in the presence of God, and he has experienced this, the fact that God is the king. There are so many things that you see here. First of all, he distinguishes he notices the majestic holiness of God. He notices the fact that God is a king. There's no doubt that is in here, the sense of the kingship of God. When he says, for my eyes have seen, verse 5, the King, the Lord of hosts. And so therefore, that sense that God is enthroned over all of the universe. The sense that the whole earth, in verse 3, is full of his glory. But what really does it for him is the sense of the holiness of God. When thrice you have that holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, and some would suggest that this is referring again, trying to bring out the sense of a Trinity. But when he does this and God calls him, The sense of the uncleanness of his own lips. And so then one of the seraphim, verse 6, flew to me with a burning coal in his hand, which he had taken from the altar with tongs, and he touched my mouth with it and said, "Behold, this has touched your lip, and your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is forgiven." When God again calls him, again, Isaiah's statement again is that he is a man of unclean lips and he dwells in the midst of such a people. And so God cleanses him. But in light of that, this title, the Holy One of Israel, 25 times in this book. You have to know that one of the things that stands out for this, the prophet Isaiah, is the sense of the holiness of God. There's no doubt about that. And what bothers him is somehow, not only for himself, but for the people, that sense that they don't comprehend and understand the holiness of God and the affront of their sin in light of God's holiness. I'm concerned today for us. It just is that setting. I just say to you with regard to myself, and I believe that. I can say this. The sense of the holiness of God is something we don't comprehend. The sense of the fear of God is something we don't comprehend. Now, let me go further than that. The sense of the holiness of God is something that I do not comprehend as I should. And the sense of the fear of God is something I continue to pray that God will enable me to comprehend, because I fear that I've been raised in a context where there is no sense of the fear of God before my eyes. I can say it academically. I can feel it in so many ways. And yet that sense of God's holiness, the sense of man's fear in the presence of God, that sense of even what you have here or what you have with John's case on the Isle of Patmos, that sense of falling down before God, that sense of his majestic holiness, his transcendence, his separateness from us, our unholiness in his presence, you see, this is significant. So throughout this book, 25 times the impact of this experience upon his life. So when you come here and you see this statement in chapter 1, which is to provide a theme for much of this book, you see this statement, they have abandoned the Lord, they have despised the Holy One of Israel. I've put the translation, as you have it here, in this next one, that they were alienated back again. In other words, they have turned away from God. And literally, if you will, if you look at the note, if you have that in your marginal note, they have turned away backward. No, what happens is they started here away from God, right? They came to God, now they've turned back to where they came from. So they've turned away backward. They've reversed the process. And as I put it here, they're alienated back again. They were alienated from God. They were restored in relationship to God as a nation. Now they've alienated themselves once again. How this is evident certainly is here in verse 2. Listen. O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord speaks. You know, I like this because the prophets are forever reminding us this is not their word. They didn't invent it. They didn't come up with it. This is something God gave them, and the Lord is the one who speaks. If you have, as we've seen in Zechariah, thus says the Lord of hosts, over and over again. And so here, again, reminding us this is not Isaiah's word. This is God's words. And this is what bothers God. Sons I have reared and brought up, but they have revolted against me. I have to just tell you, I'm intrigued by our concept today of even parenting. As if almost some people taking credit for the fact that they because of the great job they've done, their kids are walking with God. Every child, every person God created to have a mind of their own to choose God for themselves. Now, I think you can create an atmosphere. But it's interesting because God's children, even if those of us are included in that, God has nourished us, God has raised us, God has brought us into his family. But notice he says, I have raised the sons. I have reared them, I have brought them up, but they, my sons, my children, have revolted against me. Then he comes to chapter 3 with an interesting thing. He says, you know what? Even an ox, see, he has two different images here. Even an ox knows its owner. I have watched that so often in Africa. You know, it's interesting. I used to have a terrible time. Two things, dogs and goats. Goats, they put the goats out. I raised rabbits, and I also raised some stuff down in the farm thing, and I had a lot of stuff planted by the house that we kept up. And my goodness, the goats. They wouldn't go home at noon, but they knew where to go home at night. I mean, they just let them go. They'd run everywhere. They'd eat everything they could find, but at night they knew where to go home. Many of those animals would sleep in the house with their owners. But by the same token, it's just interesting. Even an ox knows its owner. And the donkey, even a donkey, he says, its master's manger. Huh. But Israel does not know. My people do not understand. You see, it's an interesting thing because many animals like this will return to the owner, return to the master, because they understand who they belong to, and they may go out and they may do what they do, but they go back home. Even we do not go back home to the one who owns us. It is an amazing figure. And for us to just stop and reflect, again, I want to make a statement, go back to Fee's statement on Corinthians. Many of us want to identify with Paul, or if you will, we want to identify with Isaiah, but we are more like the Corinthians than any of us dare to admit, and we're more like the Israelites than any of us want to admit. The Father reared us, and look at where we go. The ox knows where to go because it knows who its master is. Even the donkey knows where to go back to. But God's people don't even know who to go back to. And if there ever was a time that was true in the nation, it's true of ours. Notice the result of their turning away down here, verse 5. Where will you be stricken again? As you continue in your rebellion, you know what? You've watched what I've done to you. I have brought all kinds of judgment on you, but it doesn't seem to make any point. You just keep, you know, where am I going to have to do it again to you? Because it doesn't seem to make any impact. You just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. And so God says, where in the world will be you stricken again as you continue in your rebellion? Notice this. The whole head is sick. The whole heart is faint. The head and the heart, the major part of man's being. The head is sick, the heart is sick, no matter whether it's internal or external, every part of man has been affected by the sin. Notice verse 6, from the sole of your foot, even to the head, there is nothing sound in it, only bruises, welts, and raw wounds, not pressed out or bandaged, nor softened with oil. And you know, it's significant too, by the way, that you see it doesn't just affect us personally. It affects everything we're about. Your land, verse 7, is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your fields, strangers are devouring them in your presence. It is desolation. It's overthrown by strangers. And the daughter of Zion is left like a shelter in a vineyard, like a watchman's hut in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. Unless the Lord of hosts had left us a few survivors, we would be like Sodom, we would be like Gomorrah. You see, many of the people lived outside the city walls. That's where they farmed. That's because you can't inside the city. It was too crowded with people. But you see, you lived outside. And you see what you had that place where you stayed, where you could watch to make sure nothing affected your crops. But when the enemy came, you see, you had to resort back into the city, and you see everything was destroyed out there. And so the whole point of this, he says, not only did they destroy the fields, not only did they destroy the huts that were out there in the middle of the field where you could watch the crops, they have even destroyed the cities themselves, and everything is impacted by your sin. The whole point of all of this is as far as Israel is concerned, they had turned away from God in their hearts. Now notice the next part in verses 10 to 17, and basically 10 to 15, they turned away from God in their worship. Evident here, certainly they have, because notice how he begins. He says, you would be like Sodom and Gomorrah, verse 9, but now he picks up the term here, verse 10, the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom, give ear to the instruction of our God, you people of Gomorrah. So even though he says you'd be like Sodom and Gomorrah, he calls them Sodom and Gomorrah, there is no lower statement he can make to these people than just that. Notice, what are your multiplied sacrifices to me? Now, for some reason, when you have this multiplied sacrifices, it would seem to be that they were doing for God, a lot of things they were doing for God, more than even God demanded that they were asked that they do. So they have multiplied the sacrifices, thinking that somehow, by these external things, they can bring pleasure and glory and honor and something to God. But God says, I have had enough of burnt offerings of rams. I have had enough of the fat of fed cattle. I take no pleasure in the blood of bulls or lambs or goats. When you come to appear before me, who requires of you this trampling of my courts? What they would suggest there is that when they had the special feasts and you had all of these people, and again, the major feasts they would come in for, and you have these people coming in for the feast and the trampling of the courts, is the excessive number of people who showed up with this exhibition of a worship, external worship that was there without the internal reality. And so God says, number one, you've multiplied the sacrifices, and there is an incredible number of people that show up at the feasts. But notice this. Bring your worthless offerings no longer. They're worthless. Incense is an abomination to me. New moons and Sabbath, the calling of assemblies. I cannot endure iniquity and the solemn assembly. See, it doesn't do any good to give the external service. We're back to the issue of the first nine verses where the heart is gone away from God. And when the heart is not right with God, all the sacrifices of the world will not resolve the problem. So God says, the problem with it is all of these things. I can't endure the iniquity in the solemn assembly. I can't handle the fact that you have sinned in your lives, and yet you come before me with acts of worship. I hate your new moon festivals. I hate your appointed feasts. They become a burden to me. I'm weary of bearing them. But by the way, it's interesting. Walk with me just for a few moments back to Zechariah where we've been before. But just notice this, Zechariah chapter 7, if you will, with me just for a moment to see the relationship and the same kind of thing that comes even at a later date by God speaking to people. Zechariah chapter 7. Seven and eight belong together. Came about in the fourth year of King Darius, the word of the Lord came to Zechariah on the fourth day of the ninth month, which is Kislev. And now the town of Bethel had sent Sherezer and Regemmelech and their men to seek the favor of the Lord, and as we suggest to you, to stroke the face of God. Now they said, shall I weep in the fifth and abstain as I have done these many years? You see, we have been fasting and praying for years, 70, if you will, plus. Then the word of the Lord of hosts came to me, say to all the people of the land and to the priests, when you fasted and mourned, in the fifth and seventh month, these 7 years, was actually for me that you fasted. When you eat and drink, do you not eat for yourselves and do you not drink for yourselves? Are not these the words which the Lord proclaimed by the former prophets when Jerusalem was inhabited and prospered with the cities around it, the Negev and the foothills were inhabited? Now, to the whole point of all of this, you see, the whole point that God's making for 70 years, and he goes on to define two other times that they fasted and wept, and every one of them were looking back to disastrous days in the life of Israel, when the city of Jerusalem was besieged, when the city was broken into, when the temple was destroyed, all of these things, they were days that they recollected. He says, but the trouble is you are crying out because you feel sorry for yourselves, not because you feel sorry for yourselves. Sins. See, the problem with it is all of this weeping, all of this fasting, all of this praying, all of these sacrifices mean nothing to me when the heart is not where the heart ought to be. And you see, because the heart is, if you go back to verse 6, the whole head is sick and the heart is faint. And because that is true, you notice in verse 15, I'm back in Isaiah again, when you spread out your hands in prayer. And this suggests again that this prostrate nature. When they prostrate themselves before God in a way to show how holy, how pious, how committed they were, when you spread out your hands in prayer, I will hide my eyes from you. Yes, even though you multiply prayers, I will not listen because your hands are covered with blood. Now, walk with me as I just look at some things, because I want you to see the ramifications of how this affected their lives. Now, just look with me at a few things and see how relevant it is even to our own day. Go with me, if you will, to chapter 3, and we'll pick out just some verses from here. Actually, chapters 3 and 4 are, and 5 are very strongly in this area, but we only look at some of the verses. Look if you will, to chapter 3 and verse 5. Well, I can go back before. There's just so much in here. We can't do it all. No, notice, if you will, the verse 3, the captain of 50 honorable men, the counselor, and the expert artisan, the skillful enchanter, and I will make mere lads their princes, and capricious children will rule over them. And the people will be oppressed, each one by another, each one by his neighbor. And look at this. Youth will storm against the elder, and the inferior against the honorable. There will be, he says in Israel, as a sign of judgment, there will be no respect by the younger for the older, and by those who are inferior to those who are more honorable. It will not be. Respect will go. It reminds us again of the whole statement of what Paul says will happen in the last days. But you see, it doesn't matter whether it's back then in Israel, whether it's here in the United States. One of the evidences of a nation that's turned away from God, whose heart is sick, whose worship is wrong, is that young people do not have respect for older people, and those who are inferior do not have respect for those who are honorable, and the whole sense of respect is lost. And you want to look at a nation where there is no respect for anybody, and I say to you, even that sense, honor in the New Testament, for whom honor is due. And during the tenure of our last president, over 8 years, one has to be very careful in looking at the person and looking at the position. And it does disturb me a bit, because we've lost any sense of respect for those who are leaders over us. And God has put leaders over us. So anyhow, you look at this. So there is no respect about the young person. Look at the women. And the situation for women is pride. It's very interesting. Chapter 3, starting in verse 8. Well, we start in verse 16. Moreover, the Lord said, because the daughters of Zion are proud. And so the issue is pride on their part. It's rebellion on the part of the younger. It's pride on the part of women. Women walk with their heads held high and seductive eyes. They go along with mincing steps. That's interesting. Tinkle the bangles on their feet. Go down with me, if you will, because you look at what it's talking about. There are things that they have. Well, let us look at verse 18, I suppose. And that day the Lord will take away. But look at what you take away, because these are things that the women pride themselves in. The beauty of their anklets, their headbands, their crescent ornaments, their dangling earrings, their bracelets, their veils, their headdresses, their ankle chains, their sashes, their perfume boxes, their amulets, their finger rings, the nose rings, the festal robes, the outer tunics, the cloaks, the money purses, the hand mirrors, the undergarments, the turbans, the veils. It is interesting to look at all of this to see the nature of that which is with women. And the source of it all, of course, is the pride of verse 16 in the sense of the seductive eyes with which they watch. But everything they do, according to verse 16, is because they're trying to attract attention to themselves. But now notice, if you will, the result of their pride in verse 17 and verse 24. And again, if you look at that among the women, and you have to realize, again, an evidence of God's judgment where God turns us over to that which we desire to do and lets us do it, but lets us do it to a very excessive amount. Therefore, verse 17, the Lord will afflict the scalp of the daughters of Zion with scabs, and the Lord will make their foreheads bare. And verse 24 will come about that instead of sweet perfume, there will be putrefaction. Instead of a belt, there'll be a rope. Instead of a well-set hair, there'll be a plucked-out scalp. Instead of fine clothes, there'll be a donning of sackcloth and branding instead of beauty. And in fact, your men will fall by the sword and your mighty ones in battle, and her gates will lament and mourn, and deserted she will sit on the ground. The young characterized by rebellion. The women characterized by pride. The men characterized by self-centeredness. Go with me, if you will, to chapter 5, if you will, verses 8 to 10. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there is no more room, so that you have to live alone in the midst of the land. In my ears, the Lord of hosts has sworn, surely many houses shall become desolate, even great and fine ones without occupants. For 10 acres of vineyard will yield only one bath of wine, and a homer of seed will yield but an ephah of grain. You see, what they do, if you go back with me even to chapter 3, and we're going to come back to this, 14 and 15, the Lord enters in judgment with the elders and princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard and plunder the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the face of the poor, declares the Lord of God of hosts? The interesting thing is, you watch this, the rich add houses to houses. And they begin to get a lot of property. They buy up the vineyards and they build up the stuff and they make a lot of money. And the rich become very rich and the poor are oppressed. And that is a characteristic of what happens when a nation turns away from God and there's not the sense of caring for each other. And the pity of it is in our country. Is in the government wants to put itself in the place to make itself indispensable in the life of caring for these people, when it really, and again, it should come back even to the body of Jesus Christ, where we should be caring for those in need. And so you look at this, the care and the compassion for that. Go with me, if you will, to verse 20 of chapter 5. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And we have reversed everything today. Evil has become good. Good has become evil. We've substituted darkness for light. We've substituted light for darkness. Bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And the standard of God no longer becomes the standard for the church or for the world. And then in verse 21, they give God no credit. See, they are the ones. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. And then notice what happens, because they compromise in seeking approval of others. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine. See, the sense of the heroes trying to gain attention because they can hold it. Valiant men in mixing strong drink. You know, I can hold it, I can do it, and so therefore somehow what makes you a man is what you're able to contain. If you go back with me to verses 11 and 12, woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening that wine may inflame them, and their banquets are accompanied by lyre and harp, by tambourine and flute, and by wine. But they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands. By the way, just an aside here, it's interesting because in Matthew 24 and 25, where it talks about, as in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. They will eat and drink, they will marry and be given in marriage. And some have extracted from this so much about saying, you know, talking about the evil of the days of Noah and how it's going to be evil in the future day, those things that he describes, nothing wrong with them. Eating is nothing wrong with eating, nothing wrong with drinking, nothing wrong with marriage, nothing wrong with giving in marriage. In fact, if you go to one Christian marriage, it can be a very godly Christian marriage, you will find marrying, giving in marriage, eating and drinking. All will take place at that time. There's nothing wrong with that. The whole point of it is there is no regard for God whatsoever. That's the point. It is not a matter that those things are wrong. They are wrong when they exclude God from the consideration. And you'll notice in here when, in fact, he gives this litany of things, he concludes it. You see, they do this, but they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands. So men prove that they're real men because they can hold the drink and they can mix strong drinks. Then notice, look at this, it's just very interesting because you see this, but look at the rulers, and I would take you back, if you will, to chapter 1 and verse 23, and then we come back even here. But look at chapter 1 and verse 23 as he talks about the rulers of that time. 1:23, your rulers are rebels, they're companions of thieves. Every one of them loves a bribe. Every one chases after rewards. They do not defend the orphan, nor does the widow's plea come before them. Two things. If you do this, first of all, they accept bribes, as you can see that here, and we'll come back to that. And notice they don't defend the orphan, and the widow's plea doesn't come before them. If you turn with me to chapter 3, you notice in verses 14 and 15, the statement made there, again, the Lord enters into judgment with the elders and the princes of the people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard, the plunder of the poor is in your houses. They've taken that's why God, at the beginning, gave to all of the Israelites the land. And what happened is you could sell the land, but on the year of Jubilee, it came back again. Why? Because there was a necessity of holding on to that piece of land. That's the problem of our day. And even for many of us who sell the piece of land, I told someone today, they said, you raised a farm? No, I said, but I lived. My father owned a house for a while on the edge of my grandfather's property, which was a farm. And it's a pity you go up there now. It's subdivided as houses, whatever. But everybody after trying to make a dollar. And so therefore, you see, but God made it a point to make sure that Israel had the land and kept it. But see, they took the vineyards away. They then plundered the poor so that they could make money for themselves. They took advantage of the poor. Even if you go back with me into chapter 5 again, what we're looking at before, you see the list of things, if you will, in verse 23 of chapter 5, they justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. We think we can get justice today. There will be no true justice till he comes back again. It just won't be. I see some of these things that come out on the news or come out where people do these plot stories and stuff like that that show the injustices even of leaders, and maybe especially leaders at times. And the deceit that goes on. And then they make a ploy to try to get votes by saying that they're going to care for the poor. By the way, the one statement that is very significant, if you and I go through the Old and New Testament, see how much God identified godliness with care of orphans and widows in their affliction. And James will say it, pure religion undefiled is this, keep oneself unspotted of the world and to reach out to the orphans and widows. And as we suggest, if you go to that passage, there is no conjunction between the two. They're inseparable. And for us so often, just living holy and pious lives and not caring for the widows and orphans in their affliction is absolutely wrong because it is inconsistent with that which God demands, be it Old or New Testament. And it is a pity, by the way. I'm not so sure that I think there's a reason for that. It's amazing that what happened is for the one political party is so often characterized as the one that cares for the poor and the other that doesn't, and yet many evangelicals are the part of the party, quote-unquote, that doesn't. And yet many of those who, quote-unquote, don't are reaching out personally to care for the poor and spending millions of dollars caring for them, but they don't want anybody to know that they care for them because the issue is before God, not before man. But now notice this, if you will. So he says this, the bribes are being taken. The poor are being taken advantage of. And it's in this context that I bring you back to verse 16 of chapter 1. Wash yourselves. It isn't God cleanses, it's wash yourselves. Make yourselves clean. I go back to 2 Corinthians 7:1. Wherefore, having these promises, listen, let us cleanse ourselves. This isn't something, God, please cleanse me. It's let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Even those two passages, James 1 and 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 1 and 2, you see, both of them, it is a middle voice which says, you yourselves placing away from yourselves all filthiness and superfluity of naughtiness, welcome the implanted word. Or in chapter 2, wherefore, you know, it says, putting away from yourselves all malice and all guile and hypocrisies and envies and all evil speaking, you know, insatiably thirst for the pure milk of the word. But in every case, it's doing it yourself. It is we ourselves that must wash ourselves. We must cleanse ourselves. We must remove the evil of our deeds from God's sight. We must cease to do evil. We must learn to do good. Isn't it interesting? Cease learning, learn to do good. Seek justice. And here again, reprove the ruthless. Defend the orphan, plead for the widow. It's constantly through this book. When the orphan is neglected and the widow is neglected, you see, we have neglected a primary responsibility of our responsibility to God. Therefore, verse 18, the great verse that we know, come now, in light of all of this, and let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are as scarlet, they will be as white as snow. Though they red like crimson, they shall be like wool. If you consent and obey, you will eat the best of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you will be devoured by the sword. Truly, the mouth of the Lord has spoken. I say to you, this isn't about the nation. This is about you. This is about me. And I just do this this evening because before we even start into any of these prophets, to remind ourselves before we go there that we need to go there to understand the message of God to his people. Not only of that day, but of this day. You neglect God in your hearts, you then neglect God in your worship, and when that happens, it will begin to affect everything we do in our lives, whether the rebellion of the youth, the pride of the wives, the self-centeredness of the men, the bribery accepting, and the crushing of the poor by the rulers, which causes God to call to us and say, come now and let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as wool. And again, I say to you, as I say to myself, there is that need for us to understand that when we move away in our heart, we will move away in our worship, and we move away in our heart and our worship, it will affect everything around us in the lives that we live. Anyhow, I just wanted to go there to the third longest book in the Old Testament. Just to pause for a while before even going any further than Jeremiah, just to say we need to understand the relevance of these to our day. And as we look through them, not just to see them as something back then, but something that's certainly pertinent to our time as well. And the other side to it is a challenge to you in your own personal reading. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. Three of the largest books of the Bible. And so little known, not only by the people in the pew, but by the people in the pulpit. And it will be our desire to sort of walk through that. We did the minor prophet sometime back. We've not walked all the way through a major prophet yet. So we will do that to balance our New Testament with our old. But anyhow, we'll do that. But I just again want to pause here because so pertinent to us and so relevant to our day.